I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date.
What do you want to do with your life?
I want to rock.
Dee Snider's career has defied the stereotypical rock and roll life. Frontman for Twisted Sister, radio personality, contestant on Celebrity Apprentice, and married to one woman since 1981. On this session of Up to Date, Dee shares with us the thrill of life at the top and the burn of a fast downfall. We'll also get a sneak peek at his new genre-bending album that gives familiar Broadway tunes a heavy metal twist. Don't miss this in-depth interview with one of rock's most intriguing personalities. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It was a long road to the top for Dee Snider and Twisted Sister, and a short but dramatic drop to the bottom. The heavy metal band was propelled by a must-see video for We're Not Going to Take It, featuring an angry father chastising his son for playing an electric guitar and screaming, "What are you going to do with your life?" Dee Snider survived all the ups and downs and went on to become a reality show star, radio personality, and voiceover talent. He wrote a book, Dee Snider's Teenage Survival Guide. He's out with a new memoir, Shut Up and Give Me the Mic. We talked to Dee Snider on Tuesday, shortly after he arrived in Kansas City for a book signing. And Dee, so good to have you here. Welcome back to Kansas City.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
We have all these images of heavy metal rockers, and you say right up front in this book that you've been married to the same woman, Suzette, since 1981. You never fooled around on her, and the two of you had four kids to boot. So let me get this right. The lead singer for a phenomenally successful heavy metal band is faithful to his wife?
Yeah, we've been together a long time, 36 years actually since I met her.
Yeah.
And, you know, in an idiot savant moment, I guess, I recognized the value of having this woman who truly loved me for me by my side, and I didn't screw that up. I screwed many things up in my life,
yes,
including my career many times.
And they're in the book, yeah.
And they're in the book documented. And, you know, people say, how is that possible?
That's what I was going to say.
I say, dude, at this point, it would be on YouTube because everything is exposed. There's no secrets anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I was true to her through it all.
But the temptation must have been there a whole lot, particularly during the middle part of the 80s when you guys were way on top.
Yeah, I'm a dude. I didn't say I was inhuman. I mean, I compare it, and I don't want to diminish alcoholism, but in a certain way, it's like being an alcoholic in a sense that, you know, you want to drink, but you decide not to. Mm-hmm. And for anybody out there who's trying to be true to their woman, and there are some of you out there I know, I just tell you that the longer you are, the easier it gets. Hmm. It's sort of like the longer you go without that drink, the less of a reality it becomes. You see it, you want it, but you go, well, you know, it's been so long, I'm not going to pick it up now.
Well, Suzette must be quite a woman.
Many people at this point have seen my wife because we had a reality show on A&E for a
right.
while, Growing Up Twisted. She's been on Celebrity Wife Swap, Cribs. So people have gotten to know her, and she is a hell of a woman. Brooklyn Italian, strong, beautiful, dynamic, creative, the woman behind the man, by all means, with the costumes, makeup, everything,
yeah.
Hair. So, yeah, she's a very, very strong, special woman. Like I said, I saw that, and, you know, I didn't blow it.
You know, just listening to your voice, it's a little weak. I mean, a little shaky. Is it from all those years of singing up on stage?
Weak. Dude,
well, not weak.
Dude, you know I'm a six-figure voiceover guy? Do you know
yeah.
that?
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
Okay.
I introduced you that way. Yeah.
Man, come on. No, you know, yeah, no, I was a classically trained countertenor.
Yeah.
And I burned that voice out singing rock and roll, and it's given me an incredible career. I mean, even with voiceover work, you know, people – I never drank. you know, I got drunk when I was 14 and swore off demon alcohol. I tried smoking once, documented in the book.
Yeah.
One day of trying to smoke, but I have the drinker smoker voice, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody wants that for the beer commercial.
Well, so Dee Snider, it was something of an angel out there. That's just really hard to believe. If you see pictures of you at the height of your fame, that image that everyone associates with that doesn't match up with what you're saying at all. That's incredible to me.
Yeah, I know. It's I don't think that I would say I was an angel. And Mark Twain has read his autobiography. He said only a man and his wife know the truth about the man. You know, the wife, your wife is the only one who really knows you. And she would be laughing out loud if you said angel. She, you know, I'm barely in control, narcissist, megalomaniac. So I'm domesticated, and maybe I didn't drink or do drugs, but I can get pretty dark. Without Suzette in my life sort of grounding me and refusing to allow me to get away with everything, I would just be a mess.
What do you mean dark? You mean just you get depressed?
No, evil, nasty, think I'm better than – narcissist. I'm superior and better than everybody in the world. It's a psychosis. But Suzette, you know, so fun because – and I wrote about this in the book – you know, I would come in off the road and, you know, mind you, here I am, this unpopular kid who believes he's more. And then slowly I start to prove I'm more. And then I get to a point where people are just standing and chanting my name. D, 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 D. And I'm like, yes, you're buying my records. I wrote the songs. I am a god.
Yeah.
And then I float into the house at the end of a tour. I'm home. And she'd go, yeah, empty the diaper, Genie. It smells like crap.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, what? She goes, empty the diaper pail. It smells like poop. And I'm like, okay. And I'd float down to the ground, and I'd pull my hair back, and I'd walk, and I'd go become dad and husband again. She's an equalizer.
Take us there a little bit, Dee, this sense of what it's like to be a rock god, because everyone sort of wants to be that at least once in their lives, and so few people actually get there. What's that like?
Well, I'm going to start by saying, you know, everybody needs a good humbling. You know, being taken out of the knees, and in my book, I start in 93 where I am literally flying cars in the rain because we have no money, and my wife does makeup. She does, so she'll do makeup for weddings on weekends.
Let me just say that again. You are sticking flyers on car windshields at the end of your career with Twisted Sister because nothing else was working out at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I blew the millions that I made. The band was over. I was riding a bicycle to a desk job answering phones. People walking in going, aren't you? And I go, and fortunately, nobody would believe it. So I would just say, no, I just look like him. And they go, wow, it's uncanny. And I go, yeah. And then they would leave, you know. But, yeah, I was stone broke. Tax return, $0 income 1 year, zero. And I'm married. I got three kids. So just want to say that really sort of puts things in perspective. And now that I'm back and doing really well, better than I was, I'm much more appreciative. And I don't get carried away with things.
Yeah.
But the rock god thing is we deal in a society that just applauds and embraces the eccentricities of their stars. And the more famous you become, the more people just tell you everything you do is perfect. And then it gets to the point where if somebody's telling you you're not perfect, they're banished from your kingdom. Why should I surround myself with this person telling me I'm wrong when all these people here are telling me I'm right, right, right? That's my voice echoing. Could you put a little echo on the voice when I speak like a god, please? Talking to the engineer.
How much fun was that?
You know, it's fun, but I think everybody does this. We readjust the bar. So we say, if I could just get here, I'll be happy. And then once you get there, you've already moved the bar a little further. Say, yeah, this is cool and all, but I need to get here. And we just keep going up. And, you know, so we're always putting true happiness, what we think is true happiness, out of our reach. But the fact is that's not true happiness. And actually, I was fortunate enough to recognize what true happiness is. And the it factor I speak about in the book, discovering it at a moment when I had nothing but my wife, my kid, a car that was running, a couple of dollars in our pocket, and a 99-cent videotape rental. And I was feeling pretty happy. The rent was paid. And I realized, wow, this is what it is. This is it right here. Yet it is very easy to forget that as you get more and more carried away and as people just continue to kiss your ass and tell you you're the greatest thing since sliced bread.
We're visiting with Dee Snider, the former lead singer of Twisted Sister. He has a new book out, Shut Up and Give Me the Mic. So when you were on top, what level, where did you want to reach at that point? What were you still striving for that you wanted to be like even at the heyday of Twisted Sister?
Well, once we arrived, you know, that multi-platinum level, I already thought that I was there. So to me, it was just like, okay, now we're here and we're among the elite. And now this is where I shall reside. And my next record will cross me over to the masses. And I will transcend the genre of heavy metal. And I will move into the world. I will bring all, I will gather all. This is where I'm thinking in my head. My wife says, I told my wife once, I said, I don't need cheering. The voices in my head are screaming loud enough. I'm like, yeah, and Come Out and Play, which was the album that started us on our downfall. I thought I was going to cross all barriers. I was going to bring in young and old alike, kids, parents, everybody.
The whole world.
The whole world. We were going to be that band, one of those bands that transcends the genre they're in. I know it's insane, people. I acknowledge that now. I feel much better.
Did your wife worry about you during those days? How did she handle the stardom?
Well, I was wondering why she was screaming all the time and yelling at me. She always seemed to be yelling at me. Which got to be really annoying. And we nearly went through a divorce, not because she was yelling. Well, that was part of the reasons.
Yeah,
but I didn't want to hear somebody telling me how messed up I am. And that I'm off base and I'm wrong.
When you're on top of the world.
Yeah, and I already got rid of all the people in my life who were telling me I'm wrong. But now this woman in my house is continuing to tell me I'm wrong. Who is she? And she said, I couldn't get through to you. You just got more and more self-absorbed and more full of yourself. That's redundant there, I know. And she said, and I just wanted to shake you. And I'm just trying to scream at you, go, snap out of it, man. You're not a god. you're losing sight of reality. You're losing sight of what's important. And I was. I was. And, it took like sort of a bolt of lightning from above to literally just lay me out to get me to wake up. I mean, I really needed to be knocked on the ground by somebody as strong. And my wife wasn't strong enough to do it, so... somebody upstairs did it.
Mm-hmm. Literally?
No, I'm a Christian. I don't know if I'd say God knocked me down. I'm not that spiritual, but it's certainly. I mean, I was really just getting ahead of myself.
Where did all the money go, Dee?
This is really interesting, people, because I don't do drugs. I don't drink. My wife is not high maintenance. As a matter of fact, we were broke for so long, this original version of this book was 210,000 words. I just said, look, I just got to write my story. You edit it. And it's been edited.
They chopped it in half.
Yeah,
right?
Chopped it in half. But I'm cool with that because it would have been like the Bible, and again, it's really want the Bible.
Maybe that's okay, but maybe not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and I remember one time she was in our new house, our, multi-million dollar house. She was putting a little carpet down in the baby's room. And she said, could you help me with this? I laughed. I said, I don't lay carpet. I pay people to lay. I pay. Where's the echo? I pay people to lay carpet. She's never let me forget those words. Mm-hmm. And they kind of haunt me because it's one of those phrases. I go, man, what a dick. I didn't drink. I didn't do drugs. And I said, man, what happens to those rock stars? They lose everything. Will never happen to me because I am in control of my, of my destiny. Ego. That's what kills you. That's what killed me. When things start going south, your ego won't allow you to accept it. The same ego that got you there, that made you believe that you were different from all the rest and that you had what it takes, will not allow you to say, uh-oh, it's over, downsize, you know, save the money you have, you know, economize. You know, you go, no, I'm going to next record, the next band, the next. So you just start borrowing. You borrow against the money you're going to make because you're a god.
Yeah.
How could you possibly be flying cars only a few years from now? And I was. So you get to a point and suddenly they say, no more. We're not giving you any more money. You're not loaned any more money. You're not advanced any
more
money. You're done. And now you're in debt. So not only that is like, so now you got to pay back all this money before you could ever see any more money. So, yeah, that's when things get – that's where the money goes.
Suzette was – how integral was she to not only your success but to your appearance and the Dee Snider appearance as the lead singer for Twisted Sinner with Sister with all the hair?
And he doesn't want to let that Sinner thing go,
Twisted
does he?
Sinner.
He says,
Twisted
you know,
Sister,
I
folks.
Went to church every Sunday till I was 19 and I sang in the choir. I'm just letting you know that. I'm a decent person.
Yeah.
He is without sin, cast the first stone, Mike number one. All right.
But she – how responsible was she for the Dee Snider that we saw on stage?
You know, Suzette snuck into a club with fake ID at the age of 15. I saw her. I just joined Twisted Sister. There was seven people in the club. And she made the mistake of walking to the front of the stage and smiling at me. Mm. She was smiling at me because I was wearing hot pants and stockings. I thought she smiled at me because it's the international sign that a chick digs you.
Yeah.
At least that every man, women, that's what every guy thinks. If you smile, you're into them. No, there's no such thing as a nice person. Or if he's funny looking, no, you want him. And so by the time I figured out that she didn't want me, I was obsessed with this girl. And I just said, man, you know, she wants nothing to do with me. She had no stereo, no records. She was repulsed by me. And I said, this is my girl. The old Groucho Marx.
The challenge was there.
Well, it's the old Groucho Marx. I don't want to be a member of a club that'll have me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to go out with a girl who wants to go out with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because why are you into me? You're into me because I'm in a band? Because if you're in a band, there's always a girl for any guy in a band, no matter how big or small. And she didn't want me. The only reason she talked to me, she thought I was a nice guy. So I worked that. The point of it is, to this day, she goes, you know, that, you know, I try to convince her it was meant to be. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, she was an aspiring clothing designer, hair, and did hair and makeup, as it liked doing hair and makeup. So I became this crash test dummy for her. And she started encouraging me to be more adventurous with the makeup. You know, she would say, why don't you put some lipstick on? You know, because I was wearing a little. I thought I was being edgy, you know, and she'd go, oh, what do you know? I'm not gay. I know that's moronic, suburban, youthful stupidity. I apologize, but that's, you know, that's the kind of stupid thing you'd say. You're standing there wearing stockings. I'm not gay.
Yeah.
You know, so she goes, oh, just put on some gloss. So she hands me this. I write about this book. She hands me this strip of lip glosses that go from clear to a deep red. So I'm like, well, it's kind of clear. It kind of looks like lip balm. So I put it on. I go, yeah, it's okay. That's cool. So I ran out of that one. I moved down to the sort of beige-ish one. Cut to, I don't know, 3 months later, I'm on the deepest red lipstick you got, and I'm wearing it all the time, and that was my color for years. Same with the nail polish. She's like, put on nail polish. I'm not putting nail polish on. I'm not gay. She's like, oh, put on black. It's cool. So black became purple, became blue, became red, became pink. And I've worn pink nail polish my entire life.
But at that point, Kiss was already out. So this wasn't a new thing, was it?
Interestingly, when Twisted Sister broke, Kiss had taken the makeup off. We were continuing to carry the banner for something that was over and done, considered over and done.
Yeah.
So when we came around and we saw the original 80s hair metal band, people weren't doing that anymore. And yet we're still wearing it. And the funny thing is, you know, as I said, you know, in the cultural centers, things go in first and they're out. They come in before everybody else and they go out before everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But in suburbia, I mean, in rural communities, they're still wearing Ed Hardy T-shirts. And my manager is smiling in there somewhere because Ed Hardy, if you wear Ed Hardy in L.A., you're like, are you kidding me, Ed Hardy? But Kmart's selling the hell out of those things out in Ohio and Kansas City. They're selling, they love Ed Hardy. So the point is, who's some local groups of small people, amount of people are going to decide what the mass is like? And Twisted Sister, you know, purveyors of makeup and costumes, we continued on, and we were right. They were wrong. I am a god. No, I'm not a god.
On our Facebook page, my Facebook page, we had some lots of great questions. One of them was this question. Are audiences harder to shock these days, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a really good question.
It is a really good question.
And, it, you know, and it really depends on, again, the area. You go, even a live show, you go into the city, urban areas, and they get every show, they get everything, and they're very jaded. The further you get away from the urban areas, the more rural the community gets, the more reactive they are to the most basic crazy things. That said, the internet is really breaking down all those barriers. The coolest, most stylish clothes can now be ordered online by the farmer's daughter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I, you know, back in the 80s when I traveled the world, going to different countries, you would see distinctly different styles and attitudes. And now it's becoming a one world of everything.
Is that good or bad, do you think? Do you miss it the old way?
I miss the going to a country and discovering new stuff.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's really sort of it's really, what's the word I'm looking for? But it's weakening all the governmental structuring, like the left and the right and the communists, and the kids have access to everything, and they're becoming unified, and their attitudes are becoming unified, and I think it's going to be for the betterment of the world as the word gets out about freedom of choice, and all over the world you see, you know, people share in that desire to have those freedoms. How does this get political? but it really is just something I've been observing, and it's interesting.
We're visiting with Dee Snider, the former lead singer of Twisted Sister.
Oh, don't say former. The guys get really upset.
Do they?
Yeah, we do about 20, 25 shows a year. So
you still get together sometimes?
Yeah.
Even after everything.
Usually in the summer, it's easy on the bones of the old guys, and we go travel around the world doing a handful of festival shows. We have a great time. It's a hobby.
You know, people will forget what a long road it was for you guys. And people always think you just make it very quickly, but it was a long, tough, arduous road. You put on the miles getting to where you finally got, right?
It's one of the great misperceptions about Twisted Sister for many people, because we sort of, to the masses, one day we're on MTV, there's this video and this song that just seemed to explode, we're not going to take it, followed by I Wanna Rock, and then the world suddenly, wow, this is a great new band. We had been together 8 years. We had gone to Europe to get a record deal, to come back to the States.
Yeah.
I first got back here, people said, where's your English accent? Because they discovered us in England. We had played thousands of live shows before we ever had a record out.
And sometimes the crowds, as you mentioned already, 6, 8, 25 people. It was pretty sparse.
Oh yeah,
sometimes.
When we started out, you know, we started in 1976, and we just worked our way up. But then we sort of stalled at this, you know, local regional phenomenon level for years in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, where we'd play to 1,000 to 3,000 people, kids a night, 5 nights a week, with no record out, and we couldn't get a deal. And by day, I'd get another rejection notice. And then at night, there'd be like 3,000 kids losing their minds. I'm going, well, who's right? The suit in the tower or these 18-year-old rock fans who are going crazy, literally chasing me. I mean, not with sticks or anything. Like, for my autograph.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no record out. So we had positive reaffirmation from regional fans, but it took us a long time to get the rest of the world to notice us.
So what was the breakthrough, Dee? Where did it come from? And tell us about the day when it finally happened.
Well, oddly, you know, we had, after being rejected by every record company like 5 times in America, we went to England, where many American bands had gone before. Jimi Hendrix, the Stray Cats, Joan Jett, had to go to the UK, which is a state-sized country, but has a lot of influence on the music of the world. So we went over there and we started to break out of there. But I remember when Stay Hungry came out and we first went to Europe, we were touring, we came back home. And, I arrive home, my house in the suburbs, and, you know, we hear things are going good.
Right.
And we need some milk. So Suzette says, get some milk. You know, bring the god down to earth, make him go up to the store to get some milk. So I'm like, okay. So I'm driving in the car and I put on the radio and We're Not Going to Take It's on. I go, oh, that's cool, man. So just for the hell of it, I hit the button of the other rock station and bam, We're Not Going to Take It's on. And I go, okay, I'm going for the trifecta, the third station, the New York station. These are the Long Island stations. Hit, bam, we're not going to take it on every station. And at that moment, I go, oh, my God, it's happening. We've arrived. This is it right here. This is the moment. It's starting to end. And it went from there. It got crazy.
Well, what was that like for you? I mean, beyond the moment of elation and recognition that everyone's playing your song, after all those years, Dee, what was that like?
For a kid who was an outcast, who didn't fit in with any one clique, which ultimately I think is worked for me as a personality because, you know, I'm a little bit of a biker. I'm a little bit of an intellect. I'm a little bit of a jock. I'm a little bit of a nerd. Yeah. I've got all those, but I never fit with any one group in school, but I can sort of connect with all of them here. But for a rejected person, this was wholesale acceptance and recognition, and it really goes to your head, man, fast. You know, I mean, you're like, this is great. Yes, it's about time you caught up with me because I've known this all along. Aha! I'm sounding like I'm psychotic, but it is NPR. You want this stuff. This isn't the stuff on regular radio.
Dee Snider's our guest. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation. We'll talk about his breakthrough moment in school when he was told for the first time that, by George, he might have a good voice after all. Again, our guest, Dee Snider, his book, Shut Up and Give Me the Mic. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Our guest again, Dee Snider, the lead singer for Twisted Sister. His new book, Shut Up and Give Me the Mic, it's a memoir. He calls it a twisted memoir of his life on the road and his rise to fame. Tell us about the moment you were in grade school, I think, Dee, when you first got a teacher to look you in the face and say, kid, you've got something going on with that voice of yours. And until then, you didn't have much going on.
Yeah,
Take us back there.
Before I go there, I just want to thank you, Steve, for not saying former Twisted Sister member because
which we just cut out of the show, by the way.
Because when I was on Broadway doing Rock of Ages, in the playbill it said former singer, and I didn't realize that people sometimes make that mistake, and my band was very upset, and it came up like a year or two later, like, and you said former member. I'm like, whoa, what are you talking about? I didn't even notice it, you know? But they get very upset about that.
Yes.
So, I was the oldest of six kids and desperate for attention. My mother, you know, as I said in the book, her and her siblings were having babies like it was a contest. You know, like who could have more sooner, you know? Mm-hmm. And I quickly got sort of shoved aside as my mother had more little children to deal with. You know, change your own diaper, Dee. okay.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't really, like I said, I wasn't really, didn't really fit in school, even at a younger age. It just sort of wasn't, just odd man out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go down for an audition for Glee Club in sixth grade for a solo.
Yeah.
And up to that point, everybody sings in the Glee Club. I mean, so, you know, because they're not going to tell a third grader, you've got no voice, you know, so you're all there. And I go for the solo and I'm halfway through the song and Mrs. Cirillo, I remember her teacher very well. She said,
stopped it.
She goes, and she turns to her sister. She goes, this kid sings like a bird. And I'm like, what? Me? And I'm like, what's that? You know, and because I'd already decided I wanted to be a rock star. That came in third grade when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan. But I didn't know how I was going to be a rock star. And she goes, and I got the solo. And from that point on, it was sort of it defined me. Dee is a singer. You know, I was in the choir. I was in, you know, I was in just all kinds of choirs. It was my only solace throughout school. The only place where I felt any connection was singing in choir, singing, mm-hmm. singing, singing. And I had a beautiful countertenor voice, award-winning, actually. And then I burned it out singing with Twisted Sister the first few months, and now I've got a career.
Yeah. What did you know after that teacher said you had a great voice? Did you start thinking, yeah, by George, I do have a good voice?
Well, you kind of have to take their word for it at yeah. that point, you know. But I noticed, you know, that as with this reinforcement, I started getting more solos, and people were making more fuss in the different choirs and church choir, whatever. They were like acknowledging my singing ability. So, you know, until you start recording, you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have to take their word for it. But I was more than happy to take their word for it because, damn, I wanted to be good at something.
Yeah. So how do you sing night after night with a band like Twisted Sister, you know, during the 70s, during the 80s? That must have been just an incredible strain on your voice. How did you get through that?
Miserably. You know, I say this in the book. I no need to read it anymore, people. I'm telling you the entire book. No, actually, you have to. This the details. It's the details. We would do five nights a week, and I would sing three sets a night, and they're like, you know, 50 to 60 minute sets, screaming my brains out.
Yeah,
I lived with a sore throat for a decade. I would wake up every day in my life with a sore throat and difficulty talking. And then I have to go that night and sing again. So I was constantly in discomfort, and that makes you kind of ornery too. Just having a sore throat all the time.
Well, how do you sing when your throat is sore and you wake up in the morning and your voice is hoarse? How do you do that?
You know, well, that's another lesson I learned early on, as I spoke about in the book, which is, you know, Steve, you're killing me here. No, I'm kidding. Is the night I went out on stage. And it was a Saturday night. The place was packed. And I opened my mouth, and I've got like three-note range instead of a 24 or 32-note range. I've got three notes. And I look at my guitar player, and he just looks at me like it's the first song of the first set.
Yeah, wow.
We're here. We're set up. We're on stage. Now what? So I just said, oh, well. And I just started going nuts. I mean, I'm bounding, jumping. It was a breakthrough for me performing-wise, and nobody cared.
Hmm.
Which is how I connected. I have this record called D Does Broadway out now, and I do. And
I was going to ask you about it.
Yeah, a song called Razzle Dazzle on there, which is basically about, you know, just throwing on a little more sparkle, and hopefully they won't notice that you stink, you can't sing, but they're just, you're wowing them with it, and they go, oh, this is great! Look, he's jumping, he's doing a backflip, but good. They didn't notice I didn't sing one word of melody.
So that's how you got through it.
Well, you know,
like the Beatles singing in stadiums, no one could hear them, so they just
yeah.
they were just there, right?
Yeah, so the thing was, when your voice was failing, you just amped up the performance and the outrage and the clothes. And, you know, if they're busy looking at this, you're wearing garters and stockings and a kimono, you know, and nobody's noticing or caring that you're basically can't sing too good, you know. And I knew I could sing, but I was burning my voice out.
You know, people will want to know, was the hair real?
My God, it is the most annoying thing in the world that people think it
still
was a wig.
Still want to know. Yeah.
Well, it was a wig.
Well, of course they think that, though. Look at you back then,
It was majestic.
It was majestic.
I know.
Enormous.
I did this one magazine cover in England, and they said, you know, you look like someone from the Louis the 14th days.
Yes.
And they took me to a costume, a professional
Roger
movie.
Daltrey times two, if
yeah.
people
oh,
want to
yeah.
have a sense of it. Yeah.
yeah. And it was massive. And I went and I got from the original Three Musketeer movie. I'm forgetting the actor's name. Oliver Reed's Three Musketeer outfit, the authentic deal. And they did a whole photo shoot with a hat and the sword. And I was loving it because they said my hair looked so, you know. But that was wigs back in those days. It was really my hair, every single bit of it. It was majestic. It was a nightmare to take care of. And I am the original hair farmer. I mean, people were using so much Aquanet to achieve what I achieved through natural buoyancy.
Was it all natural that way? No Aquanet?
Oh, no Aquanet, man. No Aquanet. Is it Eastern European? Man, my grandfather was Ukrainian, and my grandmother was Transylvanian. So it's that sort of Eastern European volume that they've got.
And today, as we sit here in the studios of KCUR, your hair is pulled back. You have a short ponytail, but nothing like the old days, Dean.
No. But I can't pull the pin. I've got so much product in this hair that holding it down, I'm fighting a battle. When I do a live show, I let it out. It just goes boof. And you can see a perfect example of that for the new album. I've got a video, the best video I've done since the 80s, for Mac the Knife. And I start out the video with the hair pulled back and very sedate. And it's on YouTube. And by the end, it starts to rock. And I take the hair tie out. And by the end of the song, it's just like, whoppa! It's majestic. My wife says it's amazing because she says it's really not as quite as full as it appears. But when you get on stage, she said something happens. It's like volume. It just gets happy, and it just starts to breathe.
Well, you've mentioned this album a couple times, your new one, D Does Broadway. Why did D Snyder opt to do a set of standards on a new disc?
First of all, D Does Broadway. Three words I never heard, thought I would hear in sequence.
I was going to say. It's going to shock a lot of people.
Yeah, and no more than me. But oddly, look, I didn't plan my life past 35. After that, I had sort of a ... lived happily ever after. It didn't quite work out like that, but I'm a pretty happy guy now. When I did Broadway with Rock of Ages, it kind of reconnected me with the community, and I grew up with show tunes being played in my house. My parents loved musicals, and they would take us to see musicals. So I was surrounded by it. And, and in choirs, you would sing some of this stuff. But I was a rocker. I'm a rock guy. I'm a metal guy. And then I get to Broadway, and I'm kind of like, wow, now it's connecting. I'm going, yeah, that was some cool stuff. And it was really, I heard the rock in a lot of these things. And I said, I'm going to rock out some of these songs and just bring these two worlds together. And I'm the perfect person, like I said, raised on rock and Broadway songs. Mm-hmm. So it was really natural for me, and the reviews have been incredible, and the reaction's been incredibly positive. I didn't expect it to be that positive.
What track should we play off this disc?
Well,
set it up for us. Pick one and set it up for us.
I'll say, the opening track is a good one to play. It's Cabaret.
Yeah.
And I tried to find songs that I connected with on some level, the sentiment of Cabaret. And so that's the one. But just for the record, you fishermen will understand this. When I sing Old Chum, I'm referring to fish bait that's been sitting around for a couple days. Chum that's gotten old. It's not the old chum like you think, like Liza Minnelli sang.
Now this is going to shock people. D. Snyder singing Cabaret.
Yeah, check it out on NPR.
Talk to me a little bit about heavy metal. Why did you go there? And, for a lot of folks, that's a real hard thing to swallow. But you were in as deep as you were. Why heavy metal?
It's interesting, too, because one of the things that always bothered me about people's perception of me and of my band is that what I did, what I sang, what they saw was all I was capable of doing. That it was, well, he does that because he's pedaling as fast as he can, and that's what he can do. And it was not that at all. Like I said, I was a classically trained countertenor.
But people think of heavy metal as dark and evil and devil music all that
stuff.
It's
a choice. It was what I enjoyed, what I wanted.
Enjoy it?
Well, I certainly was a angry, disenfranchised, suburban kid. And my frustrations, I was able to express those frustrations through listening to and playing heavy music, angry music. And it really has a purpose. I often have said, the kid would you rather have a kid throw his fist in the air at a heavy metal concert or to throw his fist in somebody's face, because he's going to throw his fist. Better to go. I would go listen to a heavy metal album and just headbang, or go to a show. I'd come away feeling better. I got out my frustrations. I've sweated. I yelled. I screamed, and I was happier for it. You know, a lot of youth, a lot of young people go through frustration. They need to express it. You know, and there's angry music for those people.
Hey, outside of Twisted Sister, what was the quintessential heavy metal band in your view?
Well, first
just
of all,
pick one.
Twisted Sister is not the quintessential heavy metal band. I would never. I'm not one of those people. But you know, certainly Led Zeppelin. You know, they wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, AC/DC redefined the book. Neither band would say they were really heavy metal bands. They were blues bands or rock bands. But, you know, but they sort of defined the music. And then in their Black Sabbath, who in a sad attempt to be a jazz rock combo,
yeah.
And just stinking terribly at it, which is often the way new discoveries are made, they found this devil's third. That down, you know, that you know, down, down, down. Those three notes in medieval times were banned by the king. You couldn't use those three notes in sequence. Down, down, down.
Mm-hmm.
They were thought to conjure the devil. And Tony Iommi, the guitar player for Black Sabbath, he read about it or heard about it, and he started, you know, screwing around with it. This jazz fan, and he did, and they created the song Black Sabbath. What is this that stands before me? Do, do, do. And they said when they played those notes, when they played that song, it changed the whole audience. All of a sudden paid attention. It like lit everybody up, and it defined them as a band. And Black Sabbath really defined heavy metal, adding that demonic, dark evilness to it, from the blues of Led Zeppelin to the devilness of Black Sabbath.
You know, for every 10 shows you did, Dee, how many of them, what was it hard for you to muster up the energy to get out on stage and do what you had to do?
You know, every night, I'm the type of performer who just gives everything he has. If I'm not in pain, I'm not working hard enough. If I feel like, hey, let's go out and party afterwards, then I cheated the audience. That's my mindset. So I was always in discomfort every day. I was a young man, and I would have to soak in a hot tub every morning just to get my body going, because my act was that physical, and my throat was just torched. But that was what I brought to the table. That's what I felt. So there was virtually no show that I didn't feel like I couldn't go on.
Did you ever begin to fear working because it required to take so much out of you?
No, it was I was obsessed, not with the work, but with just having to achieve greatness through my path that I'd chosen. And also the feeling of contentment I got after I crawled into bed that night.
That spending it all made it all worthwhile somehow.
I hated the feeling on stage, but I loved the feeling, the post-coital, if you will, afterwards. And I couldn't get that feeling without just destroying myself on stage. And I still can't. So in order to feel good about my performance, I've got to perform. I can't just say, well, you know, you'll feel great if you just stay off the stage. No, I got to do that. Push myself to the limit, and then I'll feel I achieved something.
The big hit, We're Not Going to Take It. What's that about?
It was about my parents and my bosses and my teachers and my ex-girlfriends and the kids who didn't accept me in school. It was basically a big middle finger to all of them. What I discovered was the masses connected with that sentiment. And it wasn't just me dealing with a overbearing father in my house. Next door, the other kid was dealing with an overbearing father, and across the street and down the block and the next town over. The majority of us go through life feeling like we're outsiders and we're not happy with the way we're treated by our bosses or our teachers or our parents or whatever. You know, and they connected.
If people don't remember the song,
please, I'm not going to sing it for you. You come on. You know the song. Go ahead.
Let's play a little bit of it right now.
Dig it out.
We've got the
But if people don't remember that song, Dee, they're going to remember the video. And that famous scene where the angry father gets on and screams at his son.
Well,
what does he say, Dee?
Oh, what do you want to do with your life?
Yes.
That was what my father used to say to me.
Did he really?
Oh, scream.
Did you write that video too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, me and it was my, the video, the story was mine. The actual dialogue was me, Mark Medcalf, and Marty Callner paraphrasing a lot of stuff from Animal House, and but also things my dad said. What do you want to do with your life?
Who was that actor?
Mark Medcalf.
Boy, he was good at that.
Yeah, he was Niedermeyer in Animal House, and
yeah,
he was
yeah.
he was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and he was on Seinfeld for a while. But he says to this day, everywhere he goes, what do you want to do? And then people are screaming at him, and you know. So and I still keep in touch with him. But yeah, that video, that was the it just helped. There was a visual to go with the audio to drive the message home to people.
So did you help edit and put together that video, or did you just give some of the ideas for what he said?
Marty Callner is an amazing director, and he recognized this young man, me, had some genuinely great ideas and welcomed me into the process. And he said, look, stand by side with me. Tell me what you're thinking. And I was there for the location scouting, stunt coordinating, picking the costumes, what food was on the table, writing the dialogue, editing the thing, every aspect of it. Marty was kind enough to allow me to participate in. And it really started me down a path. I write screenplays now. I've produced movies. I've acted. I've done other things in, you know, with film and video and television, and that's thanks to Marty Callner.
So to what extent did the video make the song the hit that it became?
Well, you know what? There's a saying, Steve, you can't polish a turd.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. No matter how good a video is, if you got a crap song, people say, oh, the video. No, the song came out. It was out for 2 weeks. It was on every radio station.
And then the video hit.
And that was just like a booster rocket. But the song was the song. And earlier you said people who may not remember the song. I don't think there's anyone who doesn't know the song. Not one. Okay?
Yeah.
I've been
yeah.
all over the world. Yeah. Every political rally, every sporting event, commercials.
You still making money from it?
I wrote the song, yes, and I have control of the publishing, yes.
Can I ask how much money you make a year from that song this many years later?
Six figures. High
really?
Six figures.
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't for
good
a long
for you.
Time. Thank you. I didn't for a long time. In the 90s, when I was broke, it was worthless.
Because
it was that valley after the heyday where people weren't interested in hair metal, grunge came in, and it was just a symbol of the decade of decadence, the wretched excess of the hair metal thing,
yeah.
And now everybody was into flannel shirts and minimalism. So I the truth is, I was so broke, I would have sold that catalog for a song if I could have.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no...
Thank God you didn't.
Thank God I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, because it was worthless. So I fortunately held on to it, and it just started to change and turn around, and now it's just very valuable.
How long did it take you to write that song?
Interesting. That song actually took me years to write, but only in that I wrote the hook, the chorus, in 1979... Just came out words and the melody.
The chorus, remind us, which is...
We're not going to take it.
We're
no,
not,
we ain't going to take it. We're not going to take it anymore. Bam. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had the piece of tape that it was on. I'm like, whoa, where'd that come from? I was writing, you know, but I said, that's good. And then I tried to finish it. I couldn't finish it. In 1980, I kept trying to finish it. I couldn't finish it. It wasn't until 1982 that I was doing a writing session myself. I'd write everything myself. And I got an idea. And I finished the song, and it wound up on our Stay Hungry record in 1984 and became the hit it became. And I really believe that if I had finished it in 79, it would never have had the life that it had, because it would have been on some independent first album that nobody really ever bought or knew about. Instead, I finished it, you know, years later. So the two writing – the pieces themselves were maybe 5-minute writing session here and 5-minute writing here put together, but it was over a 4-year period.
I got to ask you before you go, you also appeared this year as one of 18 contestants vying to become, get this, Donald Trump's next celebrity apprentice, but you were fired during the 7th episode. What happened, Dee?
What happened is, well, a number of things. I mean, certainly, to not point fingers, I allowed, I didn't deliver as well as I should have on a certain
task. Right.
And which opened me up to being targeted by Lou Ferrigno. And
a member of your team.
Yeah, a member of my team.
Yeah.
And once that, once I showed that weakness, he was able to exploit it by manipulation. Not that Lou is so brilliant. Lou is just a two-faced piece of garbage. and I just think that Lou was better fodder for the show. And given the choice between keeping an even-tempered, focused, kind of at-ease kind of guy who's comfortable in his own skin, and twitchy Mitch McTwitchenstein, Lou Ferrigno, who's sitting and sweating and you know, nobody let me do anything, Mr. Trump. They won't let me do anything, Mr. Trump. You know, I think they opted for a little more drama.
Did you get to know Donald Trump at all?
You know, I won't say.
You were friends a little bit before, prior to the
no,
show.
No. I had been on the show the year before.
Okay, maybe that was it. Yeah.
But I know I didn't. And I've done some events, and I've – but I wouldn't say I know him, but certainly – we know each other better, and he's a really a very cool guy. When the camera's off, the lips unpucker, the eyes unsquint. He's self-deprecating, welcoming, considerate, and really makes everybody feel like they matter. And we're all kind of blown away. And his kids are cool too. So subsequently I've been at events with him, and you know we've talked, but it's not like I pick up the phone and go, "Hey, Donnie boy, what's going on? It's D, baby." What, you know. There's none of that going on.
Just a final thing. You've done reality TV. What's the one thing about reality TV that we all should know? Is there some secret to it that maybe we're not aware of, those of us who watch it occasionally?
Yes, the power of edit.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. Terrifying.
What it can change everything.
Completely. Completely. And this wasn't a significant edit, but I'll just give you a case in point. I was on a reality show called Gone Country a few years ago, and there was a dinner. And I couldn't be there. I had to do my radio show that night. I have a syndicated radio show, House of Hair. And so they filmed me leaving. They filmed me at the station. They filmed, "I can't be here tonight. I'm going to my radio show." You know, okay, great. I watch the show. There I am at the table. And I go, "Wait a minute. I wasn't there." And sure enough, I'm sitting at the dinner table silently, but I'm sitting. And I go, "Wait a minute." I look, and I'm eating a different meal.
Oh.
I have a different plate setting. They got me from another dinner at the same table. They just edited me in. So, I mean, so here was someone who wasn't there, and now all of a sudden I'm a part of this oddly silent. D seemed to be in a mood that night. He didn't say a word. So the power of edit and the power of the music. Boy, I'll just end on this note here. Just say, George Takei, Celebrity Apprentice. We all know he's gay. He's well known. No problem. That's cool. Yeah. Celebrity Apprentice, anytime the poor guy said anything on the show, they added a sexy saxophone. Lou took off his shirt. I went and got a hamburger. Oh, come on. He's gay. We get it. So, you know, music, it just adds everything. It spices up everything.
Dee Snider is the lead singer for Twisted Sister. His new book, Shut Up and Give Me the Mic, a Twisted Memoir. Dee, it's been a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for
it's been
the
great
time.
Being here. You really dug. You got me to expose my soul, for God's sakes.
It's all out there now, isn't
Twisted
it?
Sinner. It's a new band name.
I want to rock!
Looking for a good film to see this weekend? Check out our film critics, 3 to See, their favorite showing on area screens, at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. We're off on Monday for the holiday, but join us on Tuesday as psychologist Wes Crenshaw discusses The Kids Have Graduated, Now What? We had help this week from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Greta Wendelin, Kim Noble, and Maria Carter. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.